working here. Okay, this is an interview with Mr. Anthony DeMartinez for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project on the Racial Tensions During the 1960s in Farrell, Pennsylvania, by Ronald J. Rice at,
what's the address, 619?
619 Lyle, Hermitage, Pennsylvania, on June 2nd, 1980 at 5:15 p.m. Okay, Mr. DeMartinez, could you tell us a little bit about your childhood and what it was like growing up in Farrell, and what you remember about your parents and family?
That's helpful. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I was born and raised and still live in Farrell on the same block, with the exception of a couple of years in school and service, working in different parts of the country and back home now. But growing up in Farrell was, I wouldn't think it would be anything unique other than everybody back in the late 30s, 40s, 50s seemed to be like one big happy family. Mm-hmm. And it has changed drastically in the last 20 years, I have to say that much.
Yeah.
But growing up there, it was like any place else. People helped each other. There was very little to do. Probably not until the late 40s it was television. So growing up, it was more or less people communicating with each other. Mm-hmm. No such thing as locking your doors. We used to get this, the troubles that most kids got into, breaking windows, playing ball, and things of that nature. Playing out in the streets past the curfew, which was more fun and mischief than anything that was destructive.
Yeah.
But then my parents came, my father was born in Italy. My mother was born here, but all four of my grandparents came from the same little town in Italy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly. It's a place called Pesca Costanza, Italy. It's up in the mountains, north, I would say east, northeast of Rome, probably 60 miles outside of Rome. But,
hey, motherfucker!
Oh, he didn't say that word. Anyway,
both your, all four of your grandparents that came over.
Right, so in actuality, on my dad's side, I'm first generation American. On my mother's side, I'd be second generation, but we'll say I'm first generation American and proud of my ancestry. Now, in my neighborhood, it was predominantly people who were from foreign extraction, not necessarily all Italians, but it was Italians and Slavs, and that would probably be it, Italians and Slavs in that
But all your grandparents settled in Farrell?
Yeah, well, no. My grandfather, on my dad's side, had a farm in West Middlesex, or what they would call New Bethel, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they were forced to leave there because of some individuals. This again is only secondhand information, what I get. They were told to sell their farm because they didn't like foreigners in the area. And when they didn't do it, they burned the barn down.
Hmm. Is this like what they, when would, what this, this be in the 20s? Or?
I would say this is probably back in the early teens.
Early teens?
Yeah, right. Yeah, because my dad was born in 1905, and he started working at the Sharon Steel. Well, back then, I guess it was called Carnegie, Illinois, when he was 15 years old. He grew a mustache to try to look older. So 15, that would probably be 1920s. Okay, so I'd have to say it was in the 20s. Well, when they burned the house down, the barn down, my grandmother, having 10 children at the time, decided, God bless them. Well, they didn't have television or radio back then. Cold winters. So they decided to move into Farrell. Now, I would say they lived in Farrell, moved out to the farm, and then back to Farrell. And most of the relations on my father's side, that means being his mother and father, and their sisters and brothers that came over from Italy, settled in Farrell. Now, mother's side, her parents came to this country and lived in Beaver Falls. And my grandfather decided that while he was out on the farm, there's a lot of people from that little community in Italy who came over here. And they were spread in an area, I would say, from Pittsburgh to Cleveland. In that general area, they were spread out. So he decided back then, probably in the teens, to have start an organization called the Liga di Figli di Pesca Costanza in America, which means the League of the Children of this city, of this little town, in America. It's still in existence today. And they would meet periodically and have a more or less a family reunion once a year. And the first one was held on my grandfather's farm. They still hold them today. It's a more or less a fraternal organization now.
Yeah,
it's a benevolent type of organization. It's small, but it's, and again, it's it, as the children grew up and intermarried, it lost that
closeness
that it had back in those days.
It's mostly your, and it wasn't just all your cousins, it was,
oh, it was like people, anybody, yeah. Kind of, right, anybody who was, and again, they probably were related in some way, I would say, back in those days, because little towns, I imagine there was a lot of marriages that went. Well, for example, my grandfather and his sister married a brother and a sister. So we're really close as far as being related to the one family, the DeMartinis and the Zappas.
Right.
Okay? So because of that, the two, a brother and a sister married a brother and a sister. Okay? My grandfather and his sister married a brother and a sister. And it's this, I'm sure this has happened probably in a lot of families, especially if they came from small rural communities in New York. And so there was a bond that probably was through blood even over there, and it's came over here, and then this is, like I say, today it's not as close as it was. Now, I still have some friends that I was, these young, well, they're probably my age now, but when they first came over to this country, let's say 20 years ago, I had learned Italian when I was a kid, because my grandparents spoke Italian, my parents spoke Italian, and then you lose it. But when these three individuals in particular, three boys that came over here when they were in their late teens, couldn't speak a word of English, and we helped each other out. I was best man in two of the three their weddings, and the other one, he's still single, so two out of the three. But we were close because I knew where they came from, and we had a closeness there. They weren't related, but they knew my relations that I still had living over there. And it was really an experience, because I start remembering the Italian that I had forgotten. And in the meantime, I was teaching them English. So we got along pretty well. I took them to different places. We went to Youngstown. But for that matter, both the guys finally married girls who lived in and around Youngstown. But they were both, when they were 19, they had already been in a profession of being tailors for at least 5 years. So they learned the trade early in life over there, which is one thing we didn't have over here.
Yeah, right.
And they learned to survive.
They had to.
Sure. And like I said, this organization, it's not like it used to be, because we grow up, we forget, we make new friends, et cetera, this and that. But it's still in existence, and probably we'll see some of them this year. Don't know where they're going to have the reunion this year. They usually try to have the reunion once a year. And even back in those days, they thank God it didn't do what they thought it would do. But when I was born, one of the members, his wife, had a child around the same time that I was born. And they decided then that I was going to marry this girl when we grew up. Well, from what I understand, she's kind of chubby and chunky, and I don't like older women.
Glad it didn't work out that way.
But it wouldn't have, no way. But this is some of the things they used to do.
What do you mean?
Because it was because of, I think because of the language barrier, they had to stick together. And this is why Thrill is a unique community, because it had a section of Thrill which was strictly Italian, a section of Thrill which was strictly German, a section of Thrill which was strictly Polish, a section of Thrill which was strictly Saxon. I mean, even though German and Saxons are supposed to be similar, they even went so far as that. That's why Thrill at one time had, in Ripley's, believe it or not, had more bars and clubs and churches per capita than any other city in the world. This was in Ripley's, believe it or not, back in the 30s sometime. I think they were referring back to the 20s. That's why you had the Saxon home, German home, Italian home, the Sons of Italy, the two different Polish homes. No, I'm sorry, Polish homes, two different Croatian homes, the Russian club. All these clubs, people would congregate there because of the language barrier. They'd have some place to meet and stay within their own. And this is why back in those days you'd find Italian marrying an Italian. And even so much as an Italian from this section of Italy marrying an Italian from this section of Italy. And the same with the Polish, the same with any other of the ethnic groups.
Most of them were employed here in Illinois.
And most of them were employed in the old Carnegie, Illinois. Probably even helped build it brick by brick, which my grandfather did. He came over here before he was married, and he got his United States citizenship. And he helped build the building, which was Carnegie, Illinois. Then he saved his money and went back, got married, raised a family. Didn't raise a family. He had two out of the ten. He had two out of the ten children there. My father was the second oldest, and then when my dad was 13 weeks old, I believe, they came over on a ship that was partially steam driven and partially wind driven, right? And they landed in Boston and came into Thrill in a caboose. Do you remember that? The caboose of the train, right? Huh. These are things that you don't forget that you're told as you're growing up.
Right.
It makes you proud of your heritage and how they suffered and how they worked and toiled and really did their thing. And they survived. Then my grandfather finally ended up building a grocery store. Not building, I should say. Acquiring a grocery store in Carroll. But because of him being so... He was a prince. Because he was so good-hearted, he kept a lot of families alive during the Depression. And if I took it to his store, which is still in existence, and we went down into the cellar, you'd find numerous credit books that to this day haven't been paid since the Depression. But there was three stores in the area. One was owned by a butcher. His name was D'Onofrio. Didn't give credit. But it worked out for him. Now they have a beautiful store up in Hermitage.
St. D'Onofrio's.
That's right. They had their store on the corner of Fruit and Stevenson in Carroll. My grandfather had his store on the corner of Hamilton and Highland, two blocks away. Then there was another grocery store a block away. And this guy, all he did was butcher though. And he was another Italian gentleman. Didn't give credit. But his family ended up doing very well. I'm not sour grapes or anything, but just as a point of information, because this guy was such a good man and gave the credit.
A lot of people just...
That's right,
man.
Oh, including family. So I know that. But that's the kind of man he was. And I thank God that my father named me after him. I was the first De Martinez born in this country. And it was my grandfather, I was his first grandson. I was his second grandson, but the first carrying his name, the De Martinez name. My aunt, one of my father's younger sisters, got married before my dad did. Yeah. Anyway, that's the background.
Okay. What do you remember about school, high school? And tell me a little about going to high school in Farrell.
Oh, okay. Well, with me it was a little different. See, I was going to be a priest at one time. No Snickers, please. But in high school and in grade school, and I always wanted to be a priest. That's why I went to Gannon College, because St. Mark's was more or less associated, the seminary was associated with the school at that time. Mm-hmm. But I decided against that. But in high school, everything was, we had our cliques, different cliques.
When did you decide not to become a priest when you went to college?
When I went to college, the first year there, I had a rheumatic fever during high school. And they told me I was going to go to seminary right after grade school. They referred to it as a minor seminary. Well, that's when I had a rheumatic fever. They says, well, try not to, it's going to be too strenuous. Go to high school in your location. And of course, they didn't have a Kennedy Christian here. So I had to go to some school. And the closest Catholic school was in Greenville. And they had no room for anybody from Farrell or Sharon River Valley, because they had a full complement of students there. Their total graduating class was 13. They had no room for anybody from the valley. But going to school at Farrell was, if you were from Farrell, you went to school at Farrell back in the 50s, basketball was the thing. And every, well, I can't say every, but almost every boy that went to Farrell High School wanted to be on the basketball team. Basketball was the sport. Benny McCluskey had a couple of state champs. In my graduating class, we had a state championship. But it was close. It was family. No reflection. I didn't mean as a pun to speak about the Pirates, but everybody got along. We had no difficulties. We had more rivalries with kids from Sharon, Sharpsville. But back even in the 50s, we didn't go beyond that.
Athletics was the dominant,
and more so specifically basketball was the dominant factor. Football, Sharon controlled football. Farrell was basketball. Sharon had a couple good teams in those days too, but it was all good, clean fun. It was nothing, like I said, if we got into mischief, it was mischief. As we grew older and tried to get our first beer, we'd go across the line to probably, what's the name of the place down on Brookfield Avenue there?
Schuster's.
Well, up above Schuster's. Real dive. Brookfield Tavern, Brookfield Inn, or something like that?
Brookfield Inn.
Okay, right. Brookfield Inn, I was in there when I was 17. Majestro's used to be opened up in the Sky Club next door. We'd get our 3-2 beer. But that was, and cars were a big thing. If you had one, you didn't, and you could afford it. Well, it was funny. We were talking about the price of gasoline. Back in those days, the guys get together, and Hickory Drive-In was open at the time. The big movies of those eras was The Rebel Without a Cause and the one with Marlon Brando. What was that? The Wild One?
Uh-huh.
You must have seen that movie about 4 times. 10 guys in the car. We put 3 in the trunk, and it cost 50 cents for a carload back in the day. Gasoline was cheap, I think about 19.9 a gallon. And the guys would scrape the pennies together.
Just for gas,
and borrowed Dad's car. Or if you were on our block, we had a couple of guys that were mechanically inclined, so put a car together. And everybody pitched in. Was smoking in the cellar, smoking in the garage, because you get your ass kicked as they found out. But things, just things that you can look back on.
Farrell in the 50s was like any other high
school. Right. What?
Okay, when you got out of college, why did you decide to get into the insurance, or did you go?
I didn't go right into insurance, no. I back in the 50s, it was very difficult to get a job. Mm-hmm. Now, if I was smart, and hindsight is much better than foresight, I would have went to Youngstown College back then, mm-hmm. instead of wanting to go away to college. Well, the money that I had saved, shining shoes, and cutting lawns and things of that nature, working in grocery stores, packing, as a checkout boy or whatever. And with the help of my parents, I went to Gannon. Gannon was quite expensive, even back then. Well, we couldn't find summer jobs. You couldn't find a job. In 1956, when I graduated from high school, they had just got over
the Westinghouse strike, the big strike, we were in a slight, as Eisenhower called it, a recession, a slight recession. I think it was more than that. So the money I had put aside for college with the help of my parents didn't get me through college. So I went to college in 56. I finished the first year. I finished the third semester, which would have been my first semester of the second year. And money ran out then. So I came back home after Christmas and got a job selling shoes at Noble Shoe Store in downtown Sharon. Phew, what a trip. But it was making money. We couldn't get into mills, couldn't get into plants. Even though my dad was working in Sharon still at the time, we couldn't get into the plants. They were not hiring. So I worked in a shoe store, and from the shoe store I went to another shoe store in Youngstown. Went to Lustig's. I sold some shoes for Lustig's and started making some money. Bought a car. Then I went back to school, finished the second semester of my second year, and finished one semester of my third year. And Uncle Sam says, time to be drafted. Right. So by that time, that was 61. And went in the service for 2 years.
Army?
Navy. The Army. Drafted in the Army for 2 years. I had it made, though. I was, I don't know what to call lucky enough. They selected me to go to military police school. So I went to military police school and never went overseas. Spent all the time in the South. And I know what the blacks were going through in the South. It was bad. And they had their own, this is now
in the early
60s. Oh, yeah. We had four black military policemen strictly there for patrolling the off-limit areas to whites in Columbia, South Carolina. And we had the rest of us, well, we all stayed together in the service. I mean, we were all staying in the same barracks. But there were off-limit areas for whites. There were off-limit areas for blacks. We had different restroom facilities, different water fountains.
Even in the barracks?
Well, not in the military. In the civilian life. Oh, yeah. It was bad. And being from the North, I could sympathize with those guys. Well, for one incident that happened going down, I'll never forget it. They put me in charge of the train from Pittsburgh. And I had all the chits for our lunches, for our box lunches on the train. Oh, what a nasty, rough deal that was. It really wasn't funny because we left Pittsburgh and we ate good on the train. It took care of us. We got to Washington, D.C., and we changed trains in Washington, D.C. Approximately 6 hours later, we started south on the Southern and Seaboard Railroads, I believe it was called. And we went into Virginia, and I think we stopped for lunch in Southern Virginia, and they had box lunches for us. And when you opened the boxes, after you paid them, you got back on the train, you open your box lunch, and there were maggots in the food. So that was that. Then we stopped at a place at the North Carolina-South Carolina border. We were supposed to go to a place to eat there, get off the train, walk into the restaurant, and we must have had, I would say it was about 90 guys. And out of those 90, there may have been 35 blacks. And they would not serve us. They would let us sit, the whites sit and eat, and the blacks had to stay outside. I says, either we all eat, or you don't get any money. You don't get these, and it was a small, very small town, and 90 guys off of the train from the north, from the Pittsburgh area, did something, and we all ate together. That's one thing I'll never forget. That was about September 26th or 27th, 1961.
How'd the restaurant owner react to you?
I didn't give a damn how he reacted. He didn't like it at first, but then he either was going to feed us all or not feed anybody.
He wanted the money, so.
Yeah, right. Because he turned those things back into the government and got his money. They weren't very congenial. They didn't like it, but we felt that we couldn't see that, but this was the South back in the early 60s. And because we were from this area, we didn't have any of that problem, I mean, you know.
Right, it wasn't as bad.
No, it wasn't, there wasn't a problem, period, as far as blacks going anywhere. I mean, there may have been certain clubs that they couldn't get into, or there's certain clubs that Italians couldn't get in.
Right.
It's as simple as that. That's why the Wolves Club was formed, because the Rotary and the Kiwanis and the Lions, et cetera, this and that, would not permit Italians. So two gentlemen from, elderly gentlemen, both professionals, one was a doctor, one was an attorney, decided to form their own fraternal organization. And I think we do much more for people than these other clubs, because we give away scholarships. We raise money and give away scholarships each year. But some needy kid, and it doesn't necessarily have to be Italian. For that matter, we don't give to our own. Mm-hmm. So I know that there was discrimination. There was no discrimination. The discrimination that there was against more than just blacks. It was against any ethnic group. Mm-hmm. So when we went down in the South, it just became more prominent. They didn't like Italians down there either. It's as simple as that. For that matter, they said, Tony, you got three strikes against you when you go into service, and you're in South Carolina. One, you're Italian. Number two, you're a Yankee. Number three, you're Catholic. So you got three strikes against you. So, I mean, what's that? That was discrimination, okay? Now, the young ladies, they liked Italians from the North. They liked Yankees, period. The guys didn't. The rednecks down there were bad news.
Yeah.
Believe me, they were bad news. But, so in a sense, it was worse for a person being Italian in the Northern than it was for a black. Because the blacks, even though they were not permitted into white areas, they still had their own place to go to and not have to worry about it. I mean, the blacks were, they were, without, I'm trying to think of another word, they were brothers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they accepted them. But the whites did not accept us in their establishments in the South. That's why when I was a military policeman and I had town duty, we did a number, what we had to do. They either did what, you know, either go ahead and welcome us and welcome all the GIs instead of getting on them, or we'd close the place up. So we got our little jab in there every occasionally. But then after, you asked me about my jobs, this and that. Well, after I get back out of service, I got into the Westinghouse. I was working at the Westinghouse. Well, I went back into selling shoes for a couple more years. Then I got a job at the Westinghouse. I stayed there for 8 years. And this is when I become involved in politics. I've been involved because my mother's been a committee woman for over 30 years. So in the grassroots part of it, I've been involved. But I didn't really get involved until I got out of the service. And when I got into Westinghouse, I got involved in the union, the labor movement, and in the Democratic Party. And that's when I decided, they had asked me to run John Jaworski's campaign for him for mayor. This is now a couple years later now. I had been involved in politics a bit before I ran his campaign.
Level.
Yeah, local and state level, a couple presidential elections for that matter. For that matter, I was involved Kennedy's election. Now that goes back before I got into service. I was on the committee. But I wasn't really strongly involved in politics up until the mid-60s, and then really the late 60s.
Your main interest in that was from the union? Starting the union?
Started out, well, it's a two-way street, two things there. My parents, my mother being involved locally and on a county level, and through the labor movement, I got involved more on a state level.
Mm-hmm.
And the national level. And through the AFL-CIO, I got involved in the governor's election and in the presidential election. And that's when I left the Westinghouse back in 71, because I had been, by that time I was president of the Young Democrats of Mercer County and vice president of the Young Democrats of Pennsylvania. And Governor Shep had just been elected and I was offered a job with the state. And I took a job in Harrisburg. I stayed there for 2 years. And I got fired by the Democrats because it was local infighting in the party itself. Some people didn't. It all came from the labor movement. There was two factions in the labor movement at the Westinghouse. I was with the Dick Gillette faction, and this other faction was a broader group, but they weren't as strong as the Dick Gillette faction. But they were strong on the outside. See, they brought the union politics out into the street, into the Democratic politics. And that hurt me, and it's still hurting me today. I didn't get the party's endorsement when I ran for state representative because of certain individuals. I didn't get labor's endorsement because there was four guys on Central Labor Council who were political enemies in the plant in 1971.
It goes back a long
way. That goes back. People don't forget those things. But that there,
So after you left Westinghouse and you went to the
state? I went to the state. I was with the Department of Labor and Industry and the Department of Revenue as a supervisor in both of those departments. Then I came back out, and it's then that I start selling insurance. And that's where I'm at today. That brings you up to date as far as my background. Now, I think I wasted a lot of time on that.
No problem. So how did you get interested in running for
state representative? I'll tell you. When I got interested, when you get involved in politics, your eyes become aware of a lot of things going on, and you get ambition, and hey, hell, I know I could do better than that guy, or this and that. Well, Reed Bennett, our illustrious state representative, we supported him all the way, every time he ran. I was working in Harrisburg. I was still president of Young Dems of Mercer County, still involved. And it's a lot of give and take, push and pull. And I happened to be working in Harrisburg, and Harrisburg's a very unique town. They roll up the streets at 6 o'clock. So when you're through with work, and if the house is in session, you go over there and you sit in a gallery and listen. And there were certain things that were going on that I really didn't like. Not one individual, but the whole House itself, and the Senate for that matter. And this was, there was so much waste, so many overlapping jobs that could have been done away with. Well, you know, I made Reed know this, that there's, what is all this? He says, man, you know, you're right, Tony. He says, I'm going to get out of this anyway. He says, I have enough time to retire. I think I'm not going to run again. Well, that put a spark in my head. And then he goes and says, yeah, I'm not going to run. So I come back and tell a few people, and he says, well, why don't you give it a shot before anybody else decides? Well, this is back in 1974. I ran first for state representative. Well, I announced I was going to run, and Reed announced that he wasn't retiring. Well, by that time, I couldn't back out. So I couldn't back out. So we got our ass kicked. We didn't have the party's endorsement then, but we did our thing. We ran. We got beat. We did well for running the first time. And then I let it go. Didn't run for any other office. So then Reed decided this time, I swore I was never going to run again for that office unless Reed officially retired. Well, he officially retired this year. And same people came to me and says, why don't you give it a shot? Well, by this time, I felt I was the most qualified. I still do feel I'm the most qualified man for that position. Well, as it worked out, things happened. You had a number of individuals who thought they were qualified to run for the position. And the only thing I was worried about when I announced was that there would be another person from Farrell running for the same seat. That would be the kiss of death. Especially if that person was an Italian from Farrell. See, now Farrell is the Democratic stronghold in the primaries in Mercer County. We've got at least 4,000 more Democrats in Farrell than they do Republicans. So if you carried Farrell in the primaries, you're going to win. Well, as it worked out, you had two guys from Farrell running against each other. A lot of people backed off that we're going to support because he says, man, there's no sense in this. And then Central Labor Council, instead of this and that, they endorsed one of the other candidates. that Kennedy went on to win. We come in second. But if that, I firmly believe that if the other individual from Farrell would have stayed home and not run, would have won the election, would have won the primaries, and we would have won the nomination. We would have won the nomination and would have won the election in November. But that's over the under the bridge or over the dam. And that brings us right up to the present. Let's get
okay.
to that.
All right. Okay. What was the? We talked a little bit about the early 1960s in Farrell. Can you remember? Do you remember any type of prejudice growing, like during the 60s?
Okay, now, as I stated before, the early parts of the 60s, I was either in school or I was in service.
So you didn't spend too much time.
I didn't spend much time in Farrell. Now, I did spend time 2 years in the South, and when I came back, I was working and living in Youngstown, and there wasn't any. To my knowledge, in with the people I associated with, and believe me, we associated with blacks, with everybody, with all ethnic groups, and friends, would party. It was every Friday night after you left the bars in Youngstown. You always stopped at Robinson's for ribs. That's in the black section of Youngstown. And this was like 3-4 o'clock in the morning. No problem. No. Okay, that's the early parts of the 60s. Middle 60s, I start working here. There was a slight, and I have to say a slight.
When you moved back to Sharon?
Moved back into okay. Farrell, right.
Farrell.
This goes back, 68 I moved back. Mm-hmm. No, I take it back. I moved back in, no, yeah. 66 or 67 moved back here.
You're 40.
And if there was any kind of racial tension, I really wasn't aware of it. And most of my time when I was back in the valley was spent mostly. I lived in Farrell, but most of partied in Sharon and Hermitage and Youngstown. But I didn't notice, to my knowledge, any racial strong tensions other than the normal things that you would find even back in the 50s and in the 40s.
What would that be?
Slight prejudices, you know. But again, it's the same prejudice that it would have been as if you were a black, as if you were Italian, if you were a Dago or whatever.
Right.
Now, my neighborhood at that time switched from the neighborhood that I grew up in to one where we had a lot of blacks moving into the area. Mm-hmm. And the neighbors I had, with the exception of one who came up from the South, and I could understand it. He was a little, how would you put it? He was arrogant because he thought that he was going to have the same kind of bullshit that he had down South up here. But the neighbors that live on both sides of my home today were there in the 60s. Okay, so I grew up with, they were younger. They grew up in the neighborhood, and there was no problems in my neighborhood. Okay, now my neighborhood was away from the lower part of Idaho. Okay, we had a lot of blacks in my neighborhood, Fruit Avenue, but it was still quite a distance from the corner of Highland and Fruit to Idaho and Market Street, say. Half a mile, but that was on the other side of town, okay? Not the other side of the tracks, but just the other side of town.
Well, most of the blacks moving into your neighborhood in were from Farrell, just moving.
From Farrell or from West Middlesex. Some came from the South a long time ago and just relocated and may have moved up the hill, as they say. Mm-hmm. And from up the hill, Fruit Avenue was only like 4 blocks from Broadway, 5 blocks from Broadway. So how much up the hill can they move? But we had no problems with the blacks in my neighborhood. We ate at each other's homes. My neighbor makes them the best spare ribs. I used to wake up to spaghetti and meatballs on Sunday, and in the summertime I'd wake up to barbecued spare ribs being on out on their patio. So in my neighborhood, there was no problems whatsoever.
Can you remember what you felt like about some of the black minority leaders, such as Martin Luther King, during the 60s?
Yeah, I thought Martin Luther King was had a cause that was justified. He believed, anyway, they say he believed, that he was for nonviolent protest. But anytime you protest, you get some people who are, and I say people, I don't specifically say any one ethnic group, but you get some people who are biased to the extreme, it's going to cause problems. So nonviolent protest could breed violent protest and backlash. And
how about some, most of your friends or family, they feel the same way about it?
I really can't speak for them because like my mother, for instance, she's outspoken, period. She doesn't, I like to say one thing here. I may be prejudiced, but I'll clarify that. I am not prejudiced against a group of people. I'm prejudiced against individuals, mm-hmm. whether they be white, black, yellow, or whatever. If that individual, in my estimation, is no good son of a bitch, I'll be prejudiced against that individual. But that doesn't necessarily mean that because I'm prejudiced against him or I don't like him, that I'm not going to like everybody else in his ethnic group or his family. I don't believe in that at all. So my prejudice is based solely on individuals. Now, we can get into Farrell on that whenever you ask about it.
Okay.
No, I could sympathize with Martin Luther King and a number of the others because I protest a lot myself. And I'm outspoken a lot. It causes a lot of troubles. It caused me two elections because I was outspoken, because I stood up for what I thought was right, backing someone, et cetera, this thing. It comes back at you, backlash. Mm-hmm. Even 10 years later, it comes back and getting me. Okay? So when you, I learned the hard way, when you do something, man, you better think not just what's in front of your nose right now, you better think what's coming up in 10 years or next week. So a lot of these protesters, they brought it on themselves. They were thinking just of the present. I don't know what the situations were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it could have been something that I had no idea about other than my own knowledge of being from an Italian background that I was prejudiced against also. I know. So I could feel for Martin Luther King to a certain degree. I really, in all honesty, didn't get involved that much with it. And I guess a lot of people were that way until it hit you.
Right.
Okay?
Excuse me, Tom.
Go ahead.
Flip this tape. Okay, getting on here. What do you remember about riding in some of the other cities? Can you remember any of the riding in Philadelphia, say on TV or the radio or the newspaper?
Well, you're asking me a question that really I get into.
Okay.
I believe, in all honesty, the news media blows things out of proportion because it's news. That's their business. If something happened down the street and it was bad, or it wasn't a baby being born, because that's not news, or if it was a flower garden being taken care of by a group of elderly citizens, that's not news. But let something happen on the streets, that's news. And man, they're there, and I don't care. Everybody has their own opinion, and no two people see the same thing. I won't see the same as you can, and you won't see the same as I. So two news media, two different reporters cannot report the same thing. There is bias. I know it. And it's just that they blow things out of proportion because it sells newspapers or television spots or what have you. And I firmly believe that the media has as much to blame for the problems in the 60s, the problems today, as any other faction of life. That's my own opinion. And the things in Philadelphia, the things in Chicago, the things at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, I think we're maybe not media incited, but sure as hell media inspired, or whatever, not inspired, but abetted, aided and abetted. This is my own firm belief.
I think the media helped lead to some of the violence that happened in Farrell.
I'm glad you said violence in Farrell, because to me it wasn't a riot in Farrell. It wasn't a racial riot. Yeah, sure. Everybody has television today. And I'm sure that even if you watch a program, and it doesn't have to be a documentary, it's going to stimulate you one way or another. Whether it be Charlie's Angels or... And there is a lot of violence on television today. There was back in the 60s, I think more so. So when you see something in the news and you see a cop smack a individual over here with a hose or with a club, it's going to do something to you as an individual. Your adrenaline's going to start pumping. And if I was a black, I probably would say, some bitch like that, not knowing full well, because they edit everything. When we see the news, we don't really see the actual happening. We see the actual happening that's been edited, unless it's right there on the spot, like when the hell that guy was killed after he shot Kennedy, Oswald. When Oswald was shot by Ruby, that was live. I mean, my God, you know. But most of it is edited. I've spent some time in newsrooms, both television and radio newsrooms and newspapers, and I know that they edit everything before it hits the public. And we can go on even to Vietnam, whereas the Vietnam situation, to me, in my biased opinion, if we don't, wars happen. Wars have been going on since man became man. There's been wars. It's a necessary evil. Not that I condone it, but these things happen. It doesn't belong in our living room. I mean, the world is getting very small. Something that happens 20,000 miles away, we know right tonight. But just turn on the television. But these things don't necessarily have to be put in our living room. I mean, they had war correspondents during the Second World War. What made that a good war in Vietnam a bad war? The only thing that made it, to me, not the only thing, but one of the things that made it different was that the Second World War, we read about something that happened in the Philippines or something that happened in France or Italy or Poland weeks later, that our GIs were doing such and such. Here you had a guy shooting another guy right on television in Vietnam. That happens all the time. I mean, war is hell. But here they put it right in, as if this was something novel. It was to a certain degree, but it happens all the time. The atrocities that you find. Well, being in the service, they did show us films that were taken, military films, of things happening back in the revolution, not revolution, but what was it? There was some sort of a uprising in the Philippines. Just about the time when the 45 caliber pistol came out, and they were using that then. I think it could have been something that was some sort of a uprising.
Insurrection.
And they showed blown heads off what a 45 can do. And if they show this happened back way back then. This is going to go back in the 30s or the 20s. So what...
Pistol on tape.
Yeah. So the media, to me, helps to
promote.
That's my firm belief.
Huh?
Yeah.
Same thing with the writing.
I would say. Okay. May not.
Okay. Once the violence did start, your family, you were pretty close to it. Late.
Yeah.
Okay.
Neighbors.
Do you remember any specific events?
Oh, yeah. I remember a few events. I didn't get involved in trying to quell,
is that the proper word? Calm down. Or
calm down.
Settle down.
This particular, the disturbance. Because it was... It wasn't to me, to my belief, and I still believe it today, it was not a riot. It was not something that was bubbling over, waiting to erupt, you know, like a volcano. Because there may have been unemployment, but it wasn't strictly the blacks who were unemployed. There may have been poor housing, but it wasn't strictly the blacks who had poor housing. There was a lot of people moving into the area that couldn't find adequate housing, but there was, this goes back to an old story too, that goes back, a lot of blacks moved north, and I heard it from a very good source that on one of the railroads coming north, there was a sign along the railroad track that says, go to Farrell, Pennsylvania, the land of milk and honey in the south. And a lot of blacks moved north thinking this. Not just Farrell, but I'm sure a lot of Chicago. The welfare system in Chicago, in Cook County alone, back in those days, you didn't even have to be a citizen for, have residence there for, I think, no more than a week when you were permitted to be put on welfare. So, whew, the influx comes in, okay?
Farrell because of the steel mill?
Because of the steel mill, because of the city itself. And the blacks that lived in my neighborhood agree with me that there was no riot. For that matter, there was a lot of the older blacks who lived in the community, the leaders, excuse me, who, in one incident in particular, on a Sunday morning, a busload of blacks from Cleveland came into, get off of, let me think where it was now, coming from Ohio. I believe at 62 they were met not far from the state line by a group of black middle-aged citizens and elderly citizens who told them, turn your bus around, get the hell out of here. You're not needed here.
So they're going to bust in some problems, yeah, and trouble.
And that's right. Now, to the best of my knowledge, this disturbance in Farrell was caused by the media, by the very hot summer that we had, by the lack of things to do as far as recreation. Mm-hmm. You grouped on the corners. We did that when we were growing up. We didn't cause riots. I'm sure these guys didn't cause riots. I'm saying that there was a very small, hardcore group of individuals who, maybe because of their wanting to get involved in certain organizations to protest, may have gotten involved with one of the more or less nonviolent organizations than what Martin Luther King was doing. And these guys, they did not have the masses in mind. There's no doubt in my mind.
Just themselves?
Themselves. And again, like anything that happens when there's trouble, be it a fire, arson, or a fight, it's going to draw people. And if something happened, a fire, say, on Broadway, between Idaho and the Sharon Line, mm-hmm, who's going to be there? But the people who live there, and the blacks are the people who live there. So this is, to me, is the reason why they said it was, well, we had riots, we had hundreds of people in the street. Sure, yeah, hundreds of people in the street. You're going to get hundreds of people in the street if there's a fire anywhere.
So the news media just blew,
blew it out of proportion. And I firmly believe that. Mm-hmm. And that, along with the individuals who decided, well, man, I'm going to go loot this place now because it's time I can get this. I can, you know, in the confusion, we can break some windows, we can do this. And, you know, it happened. But I will not call it a riot. I will call it a disturbance, violent disturbance. But it was... The group, it was a group, the hardcore group. And those same individuals were the ones that they arrested for looting, like Levine's on Idaho Street. They caught him red-handed. They caught him taking stuff out and putting it in the trunk, suits out and putting it in the trunk of his car. They arrested him, brought him to City Hall. And where was City Hall? Down in the same area.
So these individuals get the group together, say, come on, we're going to go march on City Hall, so they'll release so-and-so. And they did, and they released them. Mistake number one, among the many that were made.
Let them go. Yeah. So the police and the governmental agencies didn't handle the situation.
No, but they, for that matter, see, I don't think they were ready for it, because being from Farrell, and I'm proud of being from Farrell, but there was no more discrimination against blacks in Farrell as there were against any other ethnic group. It was a city that, I mean, it was made up of all ethnic groups.
It's a big melting pot.
That's right. It's a melting pot. So I think it hit the city and the city fathers hard, because they were not ready for something like this in the city of Farrell. They could see it happening in another community, or even when it happened in Youngstown on Hillman Street. Now, those people there, again, some of them migrated to the city of Farrell. I know that. I know that. There's people there that probably live in Farrell now that were born and raised on Hillman Street in Youngstown. Mm-hmm. And I knew these guys. And they come over here, and it was outside influenced, along with the media, the lack of preparedness on the part of the city fathers, not knowing what to do. I mean, really not knowing what to do. And that's when I started getting involved.
Involved?
Well, not because of politics, but because of my being somewhat of a, not necessarily a leader, but someone that people listen to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I got involved. And I only got involved when, after all of this was at its height, people were scared.
What would that be, that 60?
This was at that incident that happened in Farrell. That had to be 69.
69.
I would say it was in 69. The later part of the summer. It was only when I found out through reliable sources there was a group of young, hot-headed whites who were going to retaliate, that if they came in, no one came in other neighborhoods. Okay? My neighborhood wasn't bothered. There's blacks lived in my neighborhood. It just happened in this one section of the city.
But what percentage of the total population do you think would really cause all the ruckus and the violence?
I don't even think a very small, minute. I don't even want to say 1%. Because the population, you can't, the population of Farrell's about, I would say it was about 11,000 then. So what would 1% be?
So the situation was just right, all the violence in the other cities.
Right,
it was just right. People got out of hand and the news media picked up on it.
Exactly, exactly. And then, like you said, the only time I called one meeting of the business people in the city, mm-hmm. and we held it at the Oak Room in Sharon, because we wanted to have it out of town. We wanted to discuss. Time the city was really having problems. The mayor did not know exactly what to do. The mayor was really getting very nervous. Nice. Council, Mayor Jaroski. the police force was inadequate. They were not trained. They didn't have the reason to be trained into fighting riots, quote unquote, disturbances they could handle. Okay, but I believe they let it get out of hand. The state police were available.
Okay, Mr. DeMartinez, do you remember anything about the curfew laws that were established in Farrell, and do you feel that they were a cause to the rioting, putting too many restrictions on the people?
Well, if you're familiar with what happened then, the mayor at the time was John Jaroski, personal friend. And Mayor Jaroski was under a lot of pressure, and he had a history of, I believe it was heart disease, and this was really, it was too much for him to handle. So when he put the curfew into effect, he did it with good intentions, mm-hmm. but the curfew didn't stay. The blacks who were involved, keep in mind,
City Hall was on the corner of, well, not on the corner, but close to the corner of Spearman and Idaho and Farrell. It's an old dilapidated building. For that matter, right now, it's been closed down and they have a new City Hall complex. But at that time, being that it was in that area, and this was the area where, which is predominantly black. Mm-hmm. And so when you put the curfew into effect, those people who were involved in the disturbance marched on City Hall, which really wasn't that far. I mean, they maybe walked across the street, but they congregated right in front of City Hall and demanded that the curfew be lifted. Otherwise, there would be more trouble. Mm-hmm. So the mayor backed down, which was a big mistake. So in essence, there really wasn't a curfew in Farrell.
It didn't last very long.
It was put into effect and it was removed. Okay.
Well, how did your friends and some of your relatives feel about all the racial tensions that were growing and the violence that happened in the summer season? Recall conversations with them, their feelings?
Well, you had mixed feelings, like anybody would be in fear. Put into a situation that was a rare situation, being that you were born and raised in this town and everything was fine. And again, people have a tendency to have their own private lives to lead, not being involved in community functions or happenings. Guy goes to work, he comes home, he has dinner with his family, et cetera, this and that. And he really isn't aware of problems until it happens.
You think most people were fearful of their personal safety?
Exactly. Now, this is because of when again, we go back to the media, saying this is what's going on in the city of Farrell, blah, 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 this and that, the whole bit. Well, right away, it's hitting you right now in your own living room. It's hitting you right here in your own family. It's going to be a shock, in a sense. And the fear is there. And fear has a way of, like President Roosevelt says, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Mm-hmm. Again, because of this, we react. That was terrible. This action causes a reaction. Mm-hmm. And the first thing you do is concern, you think of your own personal safety. And there was people saying, well, I'm going to sit on my doggone front porch with a shotgun in my hand. They're not going to come to my house. People were definitely afraid.
Did anything happen here on your street?
Nothing. Nothing happened on our street. Even though
we were scared them.
Well, even though there was one of the instigators, I believe, lived down here in the middle of the block. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why there wasn't anything going on here in this neighborhood. Because he didn't want anything to happen to his own property.
Right.
Okay, mm-hmm. This is again just speculation, mm-hmm. but there was nothing going on in this neighborhood. It was all contained right down in the lower end down there of the Idaho Street area,
mm-hmm.
between not even as far up as Fruit Avenue, but below Fruit Avenue to Broadway, where all the problems were going, to the Sharon City line. That whole area, which really is a blighted area.
Right.
For that matter, they're moving in the direction of, that's a Northwest Gardens project coming up. I think they'll do away with a lot of the empty old homes down there. Mm-hmm.
Well, do you know anyone who was directly affected by any violence besides yourself?
Directly affected.
I mean, any friends who were injured or caught in some kind of violent situation?
No. No. I knew people who wanted to go down there I think we discussed this before about the white backlash.
Right.
Certain situations. I knew a lot of guys that wanted to get involved.
Right.
As far as causing bodily harm, which I was definitely against. I mean, that doesn't help the situation. But as far as anybody getting hurt, mm-hmm. in the disturbance itself, no.
Do you remember anything about the Black Youth Action Committee?
Black Youth Action Committee. That sounds like Maurice Hopkins, I believe his name was. He's no longer in this area. As a matter of fact, he moved to Franklin.
the last I knew, I'd seen him up there. Well, they had a... Okay. The media may have said that this is a good organization. It probably was. They were concerned. Again, I still say that the instigators or the individuals who were in charge of this black youth organization were out for personal gain instead of for the community itself. That one individual I named already, I know it was for personal gain. Mother, this is being taped. Like I said, this was a time of the decade in the 60s where this was a big thing to form organizations, get involved. And to some people, it helped. But again, I have to stick by what I said before. I figured that the individuals who were the leaders and formed this organization were out for personal gain other than to help the community.
Think they might have caused some of the violence?
Definitely. They were part of that hardcore group.
Was that part of the cultural center, too? I think they opened a cultural center and granted some money.
Right.
By the federal government.
Okay, now we're getting into it. If you check the media and other records that are probably on file someplace, you're going to find that these guys did rip off. These individuals who were the leaders ripped off this particular monies that were coming in from the federal government. They used it for their own personal use. A good portion of it anyway. Mm-hmm. But it did. I think there's what come out of that, though, has been other community-minded projects that have gone on in the city and in the country, for that matter.
Well, to your knowledge, were there any movements or groups of organizations which attempted to better the race relations in Farrell? And perhaps prevent some of the violence that did break out? White or black?
You mean after the fact?
Before the fact.
Before the fact.
I mean, did any group see it coming and attempt to say, hey, we got an explosive situation here?
No, that's the whole thing. I firmly believe that everybody was caught off guard and that's why it was blown to such proportions. Now, people who are in government, public life, they have a tendency to listen and not listen. You know, listen but not hear. Mm-hmm. And there may have been times when individuals would have gone to a council meeting to gripe about certain things. And more than likely, there was listened to but not heard, unless I'm going backwards
right.
here.
Right.
Heard but not listened.
Right. Okay, well, looking back at the late 1960s and the racial tensions and some of the violence that did happen in 1969, what changes would you like to have seen instituted in the neighborhood to perhaps prevent it or to better it? What do you think could have worked to keep the situation from happening, or do you think it was inevitable?
Well, that's twofold, really. I think one, because of a lack of communications
between the blacks,
and city government, between blacks and whites, between blacks and blacks, between anybody. I think back in that era, we should have listened to more young people talking. They were talking all over the world, all over the country. That was the year of the decade of the hippies, right?
Right.
The flower children, etc. And I think people were turned off because of the way it was coming across from the young people.
Mm-hmm.
Older people were saying, hey man, we've been through this before, we've lived through it, etc., this and that, so we're really not going to listen to it, this is just a phase.
Didn't like the way they were going about
it. Right, they didn't like the way they were going about it. And the other thing, besides the lack of communications, was the fact that it could have been inevitable because of this, because of the lack of communication, that it had to come to a head somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the media is still there.
I think it all had a snowball effect?
Yes, I do. I really think it did have a snowball effect. See, once something's instilled in your mind, it stays there. Right. Can't trust these kids. They're smoking dope, et cetera, this and that. Can't, you know, so we're not even going to pay attention to them. Mm-hmm. And it's just building up. Like I was watching the other day where the president met with, this is in that Washington behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. He met with a group of demonstrators in front of the Lincoln Memorial. And he actually did not listen to him. He was there. Tell me what's wrong. What is the problem? They would tell him. He wasn't listening. This is the same thing, I believe, that the older generation felt towards the younger people. No one listened to them.
Do you think the violence in a roundabout way got them the attention that they were?
Certainly got the attention. Mm-hmm. It got the attention. I don't know if I mentioned this before about calling a meeting of the business people. Excuse me. After we had heard that there was going to be a white backlash, this may be repetitious. But after we had heard that there was going to be a group of young whites, excuse me, with intentions to do bodily harm to blacks.
Retaliation.
Yes. That I get together with a couple of other individuals and we called a meeting of the business people to try to get the mayor to call in the National Guard and the state police, because for fear that there was going to be a white backlash. Mm-hmm. See, hell, they were talking of going down there with pipe bombs and everything else. And this is the reason why we called a meeting, and we called it at the Oak Room. And all these businessmen from the city.
The Oak Room in Hickory.
Yeah, we held it at the Oak Room. Somehow they found out. So I called a meeting, and we had the people there. And before we even started the meeting, a number of businessmen said, give them anything they want. Give them anything they want. I said, that's not the problem right now. The problem right now is not giving them everything they want. It's to stop this backlash.
Right.
So it would behoove us to call in the National Guard before it does get out of hand, or call in the state police. I think state police have come in first, then the National Guard. But to call them in. And it was funny. These city fathers, not necessarily the elected officials, but people who were had some
influence
in the city, how they reacted like anybody else. They were in fear. They didn't want to lose their business.
Right.
They didn't want anything to happen to their families, etc. So they said, give them anything they want, give them anything they want, which really wasn't the situation. This is what a group of that corps would have wanted.
Right.
Okay. But they said this before we even started the meeting. And then we finally got the meeting started, and the owner of the Oak Room came in and says, Tony, I just got a phone call. Scared the hell out of everybody. He says, the guy just says, we know what's going on. They better be out of there, or we're coming up. Didn't know who it was from. He said it sounded, quote, unquote, black, but it couldn't make Well, anyway, he called the Hickory Police. The Hickory Police come up. They had a cop on the roof of the gas station next door. They had cop cars all over. The meeting broke up without anything being taken care of. One thing that happened that still sticks in my mind. There's a gentleman in Farrell who is in business, but he has shady pseudo-racketeer connections, allegedly. And when he walked into the room, everybody more or less snubbed him, these businessmen in the city. So that when he walked in, you know, I said, what the hell is he doing here? Well, here he owns a business in Farrell. Mm-hmm. But after the meeting broke up, a number of these individuals who had looked down their nose at him as he walked in asked me if I would talk to him to see if he can get them some protection, no matter what it costs. And I just told him flat out, you tell him yourself. Mm-hmm. And that was that incident there. But That sticks in my mind.
Yeah.
That sticks in my
Stands
mind.
Stands out.
Sure.
Okay, Mr. DeMartinez, is there anything else that you might think important to add that we didn't cover? Take a couple of minutes.
Okay, let's see.
Well, thinking about this, one more question. Are the race relations in Farrell now any different than they were in the 60s?
I think they have changed.
Better?
I think so, for the better. Yeah, definitely for the better. There's so many things that are going on right now. Like, if I could find something here. They have this Southwest Gardens project, which is a community project. They're trying to, well, they have so far worked in this area from Fruit Avenue down, from Roman Boulevard to the Broadway line on the south side of the city. And it's blacks and whites working together, trying to clean this area up, and they're having a dedication for the new Southwest Gardens building center right down the street. First part of next month, I believe.
So things have come
along. My mother and father have been involved in it, mm-hmm. along with the blacks. She's a block captain, whatever it's called, and the relations are there. Again, it's a combination of the older folks who lived in town and some of the newer people who have moved into town within the last 10 years. Not so much the ones who were the instigators. I don't think they're even around except for a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've grown in 10 years' time to be more mature.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it like you say, it was inevitable. We did learn from it, and I believe that the relationships in the city between the different factions, different ethnic groups, has progressed to a better, really to a better way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, if you don't have anything else to add, I want to thank you.
It was my pleasure. I'm sorry it took so long.
No problem. Thank you.